It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Today, religion and violence. Some of the most disturbing acts of terror are committed in the name of religion. It's hard to understand how brutality can be inspired by beliefs people hold sacred, and it can be easy to blame religion itself. For instance, when ISIS, the so-called Islamic State, began beheading captives, it sparked a renewed and kind of nasty debate over the nature of Islam. One of the most widely discussed exchanges was this one between Sam Harris, Ben Affleck, and Bill Maher.
I'm not denying that certain people are bigeted against Muslims as people. That's a problem.
Big of you.
But why are you so hostile about this concept?
It's gross. It's racist.
It's like saying you're a shifty Jew. You're not listening
to what we are saying. You guys are saying,
but
if you want to be liberals, believe in liberal principles,
right,
like freedom of speech, like, you know, we are endowed by our forefathers with an inalienable rights, like all men are created equal.
Ben, we have to be able to criticize bad ideas.
And of course we do.
Islam,
no liberal doesn't want to criticize bad ideas.
But Islam at this moment is the motherload of bad ideas.
Jesus.
So we have
that's just a fact.
Like blasphemy.
It's an ugly apostasy.
Okay, behind the shouting, there are some deep questions here. Is there something inherently intolerant about the message of Islam? Is religion itself a source of violence and divisiveness around the world? Karen Armstrong is the author of more than a dozen best-selling books on religious history, and she tackles this intersection of religion and violence in her latest, called Fields of Blood. Steve Paulson talked with her.
Karen, why did you feel compelled to write about religion and the history of violence? Was there anything in particular that made you want to write this book?
Well, ever since September the 11th, I have been very much aware of the belief that religion is essentially aggressive and it should be kept out of politics, and that if we could only all secularize our states, peace would break out. And the more I've been studying, the more unsatisfactory this seems to be, because we are living in a very dangerous period of history. And if we're going to just blame everything on religion or a particular religion and ignore all the other factors involved in various conflicts, then we're not seeing the situation straight.
And yet, on the other hand, it does seem that when you put religion and politics together, I mean, there sometimes is this toxic brew that results.
Well, secularism has also had a fairly toxic brew, too. Before the modern period, there was no separate activity called religion. Religion permeated all aspects of life, including politics. And all state ideologies were imbued with religion so thoroughly that until about 1700, it was impossible for anybody to say where religion began and politics ended.
So you're saying that part of the problem here is we don't even have a good definition of what religion is. We don't really have an understanding of it. It's not just about a set of beliefs and creeds.
No, the only faith tradition that does fit the modern conception of religion as a private search, separate from other activities, separate from politics, with a creed and a distinct body of beliefs and practices, is Protestant Christianity, which, like our new concept of religion, is a product of the early modern period.
So you're saying that that's not true with Islam, for instance? There isn't a set of particular creeds and rituals and beliefs?
No, the Quran has a very strong aversion to orthodox theology. It calls it zana, self-indulgent guesswork, about which nobody can be certain of one way or the other, but which makes people quarrelsome and sectarian. The Quran's basic bedrock message is that it's wrong to build a private fortune, but good to share your wealth fairly and to create a just and decent society where poor and vulnerable people are treated with respect. Similarly, the prophets of Israel had very harsh words for those who said their prayers nicely and attended the rituals in the temple, but who neglected the predicament of the poor.
So to get back to Islam for a moment, what should we make of a group like ISIS, the so-called Islamic State, which cites theological teachings as justification for its atrocities?
Indeed. And I'm not saying that religion is not implicated in these matters. I'm simply saying that it is never the chief nor the only reason. And it would be a great mistake to think that all these Islamic hordes in Syria and Iraq at the moment are devout jihadists. A significant number of them have come from Iraq, remnants of Saddam's Ba'athist regime.
But you're saying that they're not primarily motivated by religion, then?
No, these are secularists in Saddam's regime. So it's, again, it's a mixture of politically organized people and devout jihadists. Similarly, the young people who are leaving the West are not entirely motivated always by religion. Two of the young men who went from England to join the jihad in Syria had ordered Islam for Dummies from Amazon.com, which shows about the level of their commitment. People who have made extensive surveys of all the young men who joined first the jihad in Afghanistan against the Soviet Union in the 1980s, and then later fought in Bosnia and Chechnya and went to Al-Qaeda. The vast majority of them have not had a normal Muslim upbringing. Most of them were converts, like the young man in Canada who attacked the parliament just recently, or else they are not observant, like the Boston Marathon bombers, or are self-taught. These researchers, forensic psychiatrists who've interviewed many of them, have said that one of the chief causes is a great sense of meaninglessness and pointlessness and the boredom and triviality of ordinary civilian life.
Hmm. What if we look more specifically at terrorism? Mm-hmm. Suicide bombing, for instance. Is this primarily motivated by religion?
Robert Pape of the University of Chicago has made an extensive study of every single suicide bombing that occurred between 1980 and 2004. This method of fighting was invented actually by the Tamil Tigers, an aggressively secular organization. In Lebanon during the 1980s, there were about 30 major suicide attacks. Seven of those were committed by Muslims, three by Christians, and the rest were carried out by secularists and socialists from Syria. So suicide bombing is not really about religion at all. It occurs most frequently when a people feel that their homeland has been invaded by a vastly militarily superior power. And that's certainly the case with Hamas when it was doing these suicide operations.
I want to come back to what you said earlier about secularism and sort of it's a mistake to think that if only we could separate religion and politics, then we would be living in a peaceful world. Are you saying that we in the West, at least, have put too much faith in the Enlightenment and the rise of the nation state as the path to a peaceful world?
Yes, in a word, yes. We discovered in the 1930s and 40s that in Germany, one of the leading players in the Enlightenment, a concentration camp, could exist in the same vicinity as a great university. One of the Achilles heels of the nation state has been its emphasis on culture, ethnicity and language. And very early, Lord Acton, the British historian in the late 19th century, predicted with chilling accuracy that people who did not fit that national ethnic profile would be in danger. In some senses, you know, the persecution of ethnic minorities in the nation state has been equivalent to the persecution of heretics in the religiously articulated states. And these heretics were not really just protesting against some kind of theological idea. Most of them were threatening the social order and had therefore to be put down.
But, you know, critics of religion will point to specific verses in sacred texts, whether in the Quran, whether in the Bible, that seem to justify violence. I mean, that seem to authorize the faithful to go after their enemies.
Yeah, but you can't take these in isolation because we're violent people and this inevitably seeps into our scriptures, the scriptures that we violent people write. But they're always counterbalanced by others that preach against warfare. So in the Hebrew Bible, for example, you get the chilling accounts of Joshua slaughtering the inhabitants of Canaan. Then some centuries later, you get priestly authors who rewrite that history and insist that people must live together peaceably. If a stranger lives with you in your land, says Leviticus, you must treat him as one of your own people and love him as yourself. So that has been also a part of religion. It's people who read books like Islam for Dummies who can isolate these jihadi verses, for example, from the Quran, including some of these most ferocious sword verses, which segue always into a plea for reconciliation and peace and forgiveness. So there are violent passages in the New Testament and also calls for peace. The two are mixed up just as they are in the political world.
Karen Armstrong is the author of many best-selling books on comparative religion. She and Steve were talking about her latest, Fields of Blood. So thinking about the Bible, and about the Old Testament in particular, the story I find most disturbing, and I'm not the only one, is the story of Abraham and Isaac. I read it for the first time as a child, and I remember thinking I must have misunderstood something. How could God, who's on the side of the good, ask a father to prove his devotion by killing his child? Religion scholar Bruce Chilton says this story has galvanized centuries of religious martyrs.
It is one of the most important origins of religious violence today. And that's a provable matter. One can actually see people referring to the text as they move out either to martyr themselves or to offer their children. For example, in the letter that was found in Muhammad Atta's luggage after the attacks on 9/11, part of the advice given to the attackers was that they should, quote, keep their knife sharp so that they should not cause their victim to suffer. That's a picture of deliberate sacrifice. Similarly, Meir Kahane wrote to his own son, in God's name, telling him to be ready to be martyred. And this, of course, is a major background of Christianity, where the proud comparison was made that Jesus himself was the perfect sacrifice. And because he was, every believer had to be willing to resist persecution, even at the price of blood. The Abrahamic religions make the move of seeing martyrdom as being either the duty or the potential duty of every single believer. We are violent religions. Whatever parts of our tradition we do not actively cope with ourselves, we are leaving to others to do with what they will. And that is precisely what's happened in the case of this story. So I think we need precisely to confront those parts of our tradition which give us difficulty. I think it's all the more vital in the case of Islam today because the issue of martyrdom has become more crucial. But here, the structure of the Quran itself is what shows us the way forward, because the Quran is the clearest of all the interpretations that the original impetus to offer the son did not come from God, did not come from Allah himself. Instead, in that chapter, in that surah called Al-Safat, when Ibrahim says to his son, look, I see in a vision that I sacrifice you. What is your vision? And the son goes on to tell Ibrahim that he should do as he was commanded. They go through the story until the point of sacrifice, and then Allah intervenes to prevent the action. In other words, the Quran is the clearest of all the stories that the instinct to sacrifice was Abraham's. It really was not God's. And this section of the Quran closes by saying, "In ahadnat lahuwa al-balua al-mubin," that is, this clearly was an obvious test. And it defines test to mean that Abraham learned how not to sacrifice and never to sacrifice a child again.
Bruce Chilton is a professor of religion at Bard College and author of the book Abraham's Curse.
Abraham took his only son higher. the wind begin to chill.
Coming up, the story of how sacred gospel music inspired generations of African Americans from slavery to the civil rights movement. I'm Ann Strain Champs. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking this hour about how religion can be used to justify violence, but of course religion has also been a powerful force for liberation. For instance, think about the history of gospel music. In the beginning, African-American slaves took stories from the Bible and turned them into music, and those early spirituals were a kind of coded message of hope and liberation. Well, that music is still with us, and it's inspired generations of peaceful political protest. Music scholar Robert Darden writes about this history in his book, Nothing But Love, In God's Water.
What you hear isn't exactly what the singer means. And if you're in part of the circle that understands the keys and the codes in it, then you get a whole different message. So songs like Didn't the Lord Deliver Daniel, to us now sounds pretty obviously. That's a protest type song, deliver African Americans from slavery. But to the overseers in the 1840s, they were just gibberish, a lot of them. Go down, Moses, tell Pharaoh to let my people go. There was a message in many, many of the old spirituals that gave everything from information on how to escape. There were spirituals that taught them to read and to write and to count, spirituals that were virtual road maps, all of them sung right under the noses of the people who were oppressing them.
Doesn't that seem sort of astonishing? I mean, looking back, you know, you could imagine an overseer standing over a field full of African-American slaves, and if they're all singing, let my people go, what kind of stupid overseer doesn't get what that's about?
Well, if you don't believe these are human beings and people, if you believe most of what they say is nonsense, then you're not paying attention in the best of times. And what we had is people wrenched violently from some pretty extraordinary civilizations in Western Africa. Some of the big cities of the Yoruba and the Igbo had sanitation and running water. They had street lamps. They had horseback armies that were better equipped than those in Europe at the time. This was an educated, creative people who left wonderful art and music behind. And you bring them over here and you try to stamp that out by making sure they can't speak their native language, that possession of writing materials is punishable by death, teaching a slave to read is punishable by death, having possession of a map is punishable by death for you and your entire family. And the only thing they left to them as a creative expression was music, and they used it.
You know, what you're saying is all these songs with all of the references to biblical figures, Moses and Daniel and so on, the slave owners, no doubt, thought they were fairly innocent because they had a very different interpretation of the Bible.
That's right. They hired both black and white preachers to preach, and they stayed pretty much on the same topic, slave, obey your master, right out of some of the New Testament. But the slaves are smart. They've been sitting around and listening outside of the big church windows, hearing sermons and Bible exegesis. They've been hearing parents read to their children from the Bible. And they cobbled together something remarkably close to the first century Christian church, something based on Jesus loves you and Jesus came to die for you. And there is a place for you in my Father's mansion. And everything else is immaterial. And they just tuned out all the other stuff.
Keep your hands on the plow. Hold on. Hold on. Hold on. Keep your hands on the plow.
And so then what happens as we move into the early decades of the 20th century? Because, again, you get this convergence of African-American sacred music and protest songs. And that's the period I think of, like, the labor songs, union protests. I mean, there's so much music was part of that whole movement. How did that connect with the African-American gospel tradition?
Once you finally allow African-Americans into the labor movement, 1930s, 1940s, some of the ancient labor songs start sounding more like spirituals, and some of the spirituals pick up some of the labor songs. So two of the labor songs that go on to become very important in the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s, We Shall Not Be Moved, which is one of my all-time favorites, and Which Side Are You On, which was actually written during the coal mining strike. So those become spiritualized in a way and are sung at every protest movement from Selma to Birmingham. Mm.
We shall not be moved. Tell them, Lord, we shall not be moved. Just like a tree that's planted by the water, we shall not be moved.
Well, that gets at a question about why this convergence of music, sacred music, and protest. I mean, as a political tool, what is it that music can accomplish that protests, mass meetings, talking doesn't?
It worked because it's African Americans. African Americans have a singing tradition from the moment they arrived in upstate New York in the 1600s. They had a singing tradition that includes both the sacred and the profane at the same time. All the work songs have religious elements and all the spirituals have secular elements. In the days before bridges, everybody had to be ferried from one side to the other. And the most famous of the work songs is Michael Rowe, Your Boat Ashore, where the next line is, Hallelujah. Mm-hmm. There is no difference between the two. You've already made that jump mentally that I can use this music as a tool to overcome oppression. I can use it to help lift me up when I've been beaten and bitten by dogs and water cannons. I can use another piece of music to kind of tamp me down when I'm so angry I want to go out and bust heads. I can use this music to bring in new recruits and volunteers. You know, some of the biggest stars in all of black music, sacred or secular, were appearing in Birmingham and in Chicago during those days, showing up to sing. When you can have a small group get beat up in Cicero, Illinois, and go back to the church, and Mahalia Jackson come in and sing to you and tell you that you're going to be able to get over this, that's a powerful statement. I think the key that finally turned the corner for me was my second trip to Birmingham, as I talked to the people who were in those sometimes nightly mass meetings. And they would last about 3 hours. Remember, you're at probably a spear point in history for African Americans in this country. You've got an entire country that's indifferent to your plight. You have a local government that's against you. You've got the Klan and the paramilitary groups that are bombing and killing your people. Only 10% of blacks are supporting you in that time, and so you have to get a lot done in these 3 hours. So you spend 15, 20 minutes on instructions. I need 100 people arrested at 16th Street Baptist Church at noon. I need 50 people arrested downtown. You spend 30, 45 minutes with preaching, Martin Luther King, Fred Shuttlesworth, but you spend the other 2 hours singing. In your most important time, you're spending two of your hours singing. And the amazing thing is, even though these meetings generally began at 7 o'clock, the churches started filling up in the afternoon. And they sang without a song leader until King and the rest of them showed up. And they sang after they left, and they sang on the way home.
What did that singing do for them, mean to them?
It meant the world to them, man. It meant, I have something bigger than myself that's on my side. You know, American slavery was the worst slavery that we know about because it's a lone slavery that had no hope of manumission for your descendants. You were a perpetual slave. There was no way out. And you had to believe there were better times coming, either in heaven or because you could use the song Follow the Drinking Gourd and get to the Ohio River and get across to safety. The same was with the freedom songs and the protest spirituals of the 1960s. We're part of something bigger. God is pleased by my efforts. And just as the Lord delivered Moses and the children of Israel out of Egypt and bondage, so will God, if we are faithful, deliver us.
We were talking about those
early days of the Montgomery bus boycott in, you know, 55 and 56. And there's a particular concert you write about, Ralph Abernathy, called Mahalia Jackson. The great gospel singer was up in Chicago and asked her to come sing at a fundraising rally. And this was at a time when I think she stayed at Abernathy's house, and his house was bombed shortly after. So, you know, it was a very heated time. What was the concert like?
There hadn't been somebody of Mahalia's stature. And of course, she was the best-known African-American in the country, right up there with Joe Louis and Louis Armstrong and Duke Ellington and maybe Belafonte and Portier.
And she was politically powerful. She'd helped elect Richard Daley up in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. And she stayed politically involved to her very end of her days. And she walks into this church, and I think it's around Christmas time. She sings both the old songs and then some of the new. And people who were there talk about there being like a halo around the church. They knew there were people standing around outside that church from the posses and the paramilitary organizations and the police, but they felt a sense of peace and calm while she was singing in that church, and they sang together because she always made people sing with her.
Oh, will you be there? Tell me, will you be there?
Things that's so powerful about all of this music and its grounding in the sacred tradition is mm-hmm. what it does to a political stance. You know, the freedom movement wasn't just about trying to pass certain laws. It was about sin, evil, goodness, redemption. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a sacred context that gets added to what could have simply been a political movement. I'm not saying it well, but do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and you have to have the laws change. No, I can't change your heart, but I can pass a law to keep you from beating me and to keep you from keeping me from having my constitutional rights. But hearts are changed. And when people hear these songs, black and white, when the white volunteers come down and they want to do the right thing and they're idealistic, but they don't become true believers till they go to their first mass meeting and hear the singing, and in their letters home, they write, I get it now. I'm not a religious person, but I want to go to church and hear this music, and I want to be a part of what is going on here. And the music was the transformative agent for them. And you need both. You have to have the lawsuits. But if you want to transform people's hearts and minds, if you want to rally the troops, and if you want to have something that endures and they can take home and hum and keep what you've learned on your mind, then you need the music.
Baylor University professor Robert Darden. He's the former gospel music editor for Billboard magazine and author of a book called Nothing But Love in God's Water. So it's pretty clear the Bible has fed both freedom movements and also appalling brutality. What if we had a book of chapter and verse with all the good stuff in the Bible, the poetry, the wisdom, the moral guidance, without the baggage that comes with religious doctrine? It might sound something like this.
Sages, chapter 1. How does the master learn? By being gentle, kind, courteous, modest, and patient. Such inquiry is different from all others. What is a good person? One who doesn't seek to be satiated in eating, one who is quick in dealings, prudent in speech, correct in action. At 15, I aspired to learning. At 30, I established my stand. At 40, I had no illusions. At 50, I knew my destiny. At 60, I recognized truth when it came. At 70, I could follow my heart's wishes without wrongdoing.
That's philosopher A.C. Grayling reading from his humanist Bible, which he's called The Good Book. Steve Paulson caught up with him recently to talk about the philosophy behind humanism.
Now, you have a new book called The God Argument, which is a kind of manifesto against religion and for humanism. What does it mean to be a humanist?
It means really having an attitude, because humanism is not a code or a doctrine or a set of teachings. Rather, it's an invitation to start thinking about how one might live a flourishing and worthwhile life, a life of achievement, by thinking a bit about what it is to be a human being.
So what are the core differences between being a humanist and being a religious person?
Well, the chief difference is that most of the great religious moralities are what are sometimes called divine command moralities. There is a law, a moral law, a code, a set of commandments, thou shalt not. And they ask us to submit our will and our judgment to the deity. For example, Islam means submission. In Christianity, a very common theme is not my will, but thy will be done. This is very contrasted, really, to the humanist outlook, which says we must, as individuals, take responsibility for ourselves, and we have to think about how we're going to live if we're to live well.
Now, you actually describe yourself as a humanist, a secularist, and an atheist, and each one of those words has a different meaning. Can you briefly define each?
Yes, indeed. And it's important, actually, that one does distinguish between the three, because there are three different debates, even though they're also naturally connected, obviously. The atheism-theism debate is really a metaphysical one. What is the universe like? Does it contain supernatural or transcendent agencies of some kind? The secularism debate is about the place and volume of the religious voice in the public square and how much influence religious lobbies should have in education, public policy matters, and in scientific research. And the third debate is the ethical debate. What is the basis of trying to live with responsibility towards others? How do we form good relationships? And what things really matter in life?
My sense is your critique of the Bible goes a lot further than just you don't find it meaningful. I mean, you actively dislike this book, don't you?
Well, there are certainly very unedifying parts of it and some downright disgraceful parts of it. So a good deal of massacring goes on in the Old Testament as a result of the annoyance that the deity feels towards his creation. But there are also, of course, very beautiful passages and very illuminating ones. My favourite bit is the Song of Solomon, which, of course, is a love poem, and it's a very beautiful and moving one. There is wisdom in the Proverbs and in Ecclesiastes. What I disagree with, I suppose, is the idea that our view of the world, both on a factual basis, an empirical basis, and our view of how we're to live our lives, tends to be both distorted by different religious takes on these things, the different religious traditions, and so many conflicts arise out of them because different groups of people think that their gods or their version of God have told them things that are different from other people's.
So religion has a lot to answer for in your mind, especially when it comes to violence.
It does. I think religion, if one were to balance up on the one hand the inspiration it's given in the way of art and music, the comfort it's given to individuals on their own in the dark at the end of life in moments of terror, if one balances that with the overall weight of religion on history, on human history, I think the balance has been very largely negative.
And yet, if we're just going to focus on violence for a moment, as you look back at the worst episodes of violence of the 20th century, you'd have to say most of them were caused by atheists. Stalin, Mao, Pol Pot. There's an argument about Hitler, of course, whether he was actually an atheist, but none of them were religious believers. In fact, most of those were avowed atheists.
Well, this is a dreadful canard which is trotted out at every opportunity, really, isn't it? I mean, these things weren't done in the name of atheism.
No, of course not.
Hitler wasn't an atheist. And also, the point about Stalinism and Nazism and Mao and any Calvinist church you care to name, or Islam in Muslim-majority countries where there's a particularly fundamentalist version of it, they all share one thing in common. They are all totalizing ideologies. They will say, we know the answer, we've got the truth. And if you don't toe the line, you're in big trouble. And they have more in common in that way than they have differences.
Now, you have done something quite audacious, I have to say. You've written your own Bible, a humanist Bible, what you call the Good Book, which is actually full of books and verses. Why did you want to do this?
Well, firstly, I should say that I didn't write it. I made it. about 30 or more years ago, when I was a graduate student at Oxford, I was thinking a bit about the rather interesting contrast between religious moralities and humanist moralities. And I thought to myself, well, it's such a great pity, really, that the makers of the religious Bible went to a great variety of texts and wove them into one another and paraphrased them and redacted them and edited them. But I thought it was a great pity that they went to religious texts rather than to the philosophers and historians and poets, because they would have been able to draw from them wonderful texts of insight and inspiration and consolation, of understanding of what it is to be human. And they could have put together a very, very different book.
So that's what your book is? It's actually a collection of what various people have written?
Exactly. So what I did was I went to all these great texts of the past and I performed on them the same act as the Bible makers perform, that is, selecting, editing, interweaving, and so forth. And I constructed it in the same way as the Bible of Religion, that is, in chapter and verse. I think that those great insights and inspirations from the secular writings of the world have every bit as much power and depth as the religious writings do, if indeed not more. And I wanted to present the book in the same way to show that it is entitled to sit on the same shelf, or even indeed maybe supplant what's on that shelf.
Well, good luck in that regard.
Well, give me a couple of centuries. You never know. I may myself be a god then, you know.
Well,
I certainly hope not, by the way. I'll be a very bad one.
Give us a taste. And we should point out that you actually start your humanist Bible with a book called Genesis, your story of the origins. Can you read some from that?
I certainly will, yes. And my good book begins also in a garden, but a slightly different garden from the Garden of Eden, and it goes like this. Genesis chapter 1. In the garden stands a tree. In springtime it bears flowers, in the autumn fruit. Its fruit is knowledge, teaching the good gardener how to understand the world. From it he learns how the tree grows from seed to sapling, from sapling to maturity, at last ready to offer more life, and from maturity to age and sleep, whence it returns to the elements of things. It was from the fall of a fruit from such a tree that new inspiration came for inquiry into the nature of things. When Newton sat in his garden and saw what no one had seen before, that an apple draws the earth to itself and the earth the apple. So all things are gathered into one thing, the universe of nature, in which there are many worlds, the orbs of light in an immensity of space and time, and among them there are satellites, on one of which is part of nature that mirrors nature in itself, and can ponder its beauty and significance and seek to understand it. This is humankind.
That's A.C. Grayling reading from his humanist Bible, which he calls The Good Book. He also talked with Steve Paulson about his new book, The God Argument. So what do you think? Does religion, on balance, do more harm or more good? You can share your thoughts on our Facebook page or on our website at ttbook.org. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back to celebrate the fiction of Mario Vargas Llosa and hear about an unusual photography project in Louisiana's Angola prison. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now, bookmarks, writers on books they love.
My name is Emily Parker, and I'm the author of Now I Know Who My Comrades Are, Voices from the Internet Underground. The book that I would like to recommend is called Conversation in the Cathedral. It's by Mario Vargas Llosa, who won the Nobel Prize for Literature. I think that Conversation in the Cathedral is a book that maybe less people have read. It's a long book, it's a complicated book, and it's a difficult book. But I think it is one of the best examples of how a novel can describe life under a dictatorship. And so what Vargas Llosa does in this book is he just describes how dictatorships influence every aspect of life, and political repression influences every aspect of life. It can be relationships between friends, it can be relationships between fathers and sons, it can just be the general ambiance at a bar. And he really just creates this atmosphere of what it feels like to live in a world where you don't feel free. And I think this book is important because there's so much written about repressive governments and about freedom, and a lot of this is written in the form of articles or nonfiction, but sometimes fiction can uniquely capture the atmosphere of life in this kind of political environment. I'm very proud to say that Vargas Llosa actually read my book and wrote an article about it, and which was the most exciting thing that has ever happened because he's really one of my favorite authors. Vargas Llosa is a very renowned novelist. He's written both fiction and nonfiction. One of his main causes in life is writing about the struggle for freedom. And I think that he has realized and he has expressed that sometimes fiction is the most powerful way to describe this phenomenon. Another one of his books is called The Feast of the Goat, which is about the Dominican Republic. In that book as well, he really describes the life of people who are sort of deprived of basic freedoms. And I think Vargas Llosa's work is really important because we often talk about political repression in very abstract terms. And I think when you're reading a newspaper article, sometimes it's hard to really understand how these political systems affect average people. And Vargas Llosa's novels do that brilliantly. I started reading him a few years ago, and I think I started with Conversation in the Cathedral, which, again, is a very difficult book. You kind of read it, and it's very hard at first to understand what's going on, and it's very confusing. I felt that I was pulled into this dark world, and you feel almost uneasy reading, and you feel almost sick reading it, like you're kind of living in this unhealthy environment. And I just remember thinking, wow, this is a really powerful novel.
Emily Parker recommends Conversation in the Cathedral by Mario Vargas Llosa. You'll find more bookmarks and an interview with Parker on our website. That's at ttbook.org. For the past 30 years, photographers Keith Calhoun and Chandra McCormick have been documenting life in New Orleans and Louisiana. And this winter, for the first time, they're exhibiting a series of photographs taken over years of visits to the Louisiana State Penitentiary, also known as Angola. It's a rare and sometimes heartbreaking glimpse of life behind bars. Sarah Nix sat down to talk with them.
Keith, my understanding is that you first went into the Louisiana State Penitentiary in the 80s to make some photographs. Could you just talk a little bit about some of the scenes you saw when you first went there?
Yeah, when I first went to Angola, I was collaborating with a French photographer who had came down to do a book on New Orleans, and he had asked me what type of places I would like to be able to go to. And I know that he had the power as a French journalist to pretty much go anywhere he wanted to go. So I said, let's go to Angola. I was able to see slavery. You know, I've seen men walking in the fields, walking behind mules, and especially in a cell block, you know, very seldom you get to really see how men living in those horrible conditions, you know. Two men, maybe, or three men into a little 4x6 cell, you know, that's pretty much the typical situation in the lockdown area, you know.
It also was born through our love for the documentary work that we do, which is on laborers throughout, you know, Louisiana. And so as a part of the labor series, we did sugarcane and people who worked in cotton. Angola, we found out about that having a very large population of field work. And
I mean, it was like stepping back in time, you know. It was pretty much seeing life in the old days to me, coming from from the community and seeing so many people that I knew that was in Angola, it was very challenging to see life behind bars. So I was pretty much able to find out places to go in Angola, normally where the cameras wouldn't go. You know, I would ask guys who've been there, they would say, man, you need to go to the lockdown. They normally don't show that to photographers, you know.
And that's where men are in their cells for 23 hours a day, right?
Yeah, that's what people like. I mean, that's what they call it, the dungeon in Angola.
Do you have a favorite photograph from that first visit?
Yeah, one of my favorite photos is the men playing chess. It's called 23-hour lockdown, and it's guys in the cell block with their hands out the cell playing chess with one another.
Yeah, and it's kind of shot down the hallway, right? Is that the one I'm thinking of?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's a beautiful photograph. Chandra, what was it like for you the first time you went in?
It was kind of hard to see all those people locked up. I saw one person, actually, that I knew. He saw me, and he asked the warden if he could talk to me. That particular person was a high school mate of mine, and I had, I guess, totally forgotten about that situation with him.
You'd forgotten that he was incarcerated?
Yeah. Mm.
Keith, you have a remarkable photograph that you took, I think, when you were first visiting Angola in 1981, of a guard watching over some inmates. Could you explain that photograph just a little bit?
Well, it's called The Boss on the Horse, because in Angola, everybody have to work. It's typical to see this man in the field all day with a shotgun, and there's an old prison song, say, I don't know that man on the horse. All I know, they call him Boss. And as a boy growing up hearing that song, I couldn't help but compose that shot of that man, you know, riding shotgun all day on the horse. So, you know, when we look at that picture, it could be 100 years back in time. When you look at Angola 100 years ago, what you've seen black people told in the field is still pretty much the same today. In 2014, you can go right now, there are men walking in the field.
Of course, there are a couple of names for Louisiana State Penitentiary, right? There's Angola, the farm, and you've called the prison a plantation, and that the work that people are being put to there, you've called that slavery. Do you want to talk a little bit about that, explain that?
Yes, because the work that I see the men doing and the way they're overseen, it's no different than what you see during slavery. And I realized that maybe prisons are needed for certain people, or certain people do things that they need to be punished for. But I don't feel that anyone should be dehumanized, or just that work. They could do a lot of other things to rehabilitate prisoners.
How many times in all have you been to Angola to take photos?
Maybe a dozen times.
Keith, do you find that you've seen much change, or what kind of change have you seen over the years?
Well, to me, it's worse because the conditions when we started shooting in the dormitories, for instance, at one time it was like 100 men. Now it's 200 men in the dorm, and it's like 5 showers for 200 men.
What has happened is the population has changed, but the amount of space for bathrooms and showers and stuff like that hasn't changed. The population has doubled while those things have remained the same.
For instance, in the morning when the men go on to work in the fields, there's no portalets. There's nowhere for them to do their business unless they do it in the field. So those type of conditions to me are pretty embarrassing to still have to, you know, squat in the field in the morning. That's the same things we had to do in slavery. And just as far as the working conditions, you know, the inmates are not entitled to reap any of the crops. You're only making, what, 8-10 cents an hour. How are you going to survive? Well, you have to prey on other inmates to survive.
Have you guys had any run-in with prison officials when you've exhibited photos? Have they had any reaction to your work?
Well, really, this is the first major show we've just been documenting for years, and finally we put together this show.
And what kind of reactions are you getting?
There's a lot of response. Everybody is very impressed with the quality of the exhibit, but people just don't believe that people still walking in the fields like that.
There are some guys that keep photographed who are now out of prison, and the response is great. They love it. It's a tool to create awareness.
The work is what I've seen of it is really very beautiful and shocking. Do you think it will travel outside of New Orleans as well?
We're hoping that we can get the show to really travel through inner cities, especially the more I think young people see, because a lot of people from my community, they don't see it till they're there, and it's too late. So it's important that they have an understanding that, you know, this is no joke.
Sarah next talked with Keith Calhoun and Chandra McCormick about their photos of the Louisiana State Penitentiary. The pictures were on exhibition at New Orleans Ogden Museum of Southern Art, and you can see some of them on our website at ttbook.org. That's it for our show today, but there's more in our podcast feed. To sign up, just visit iTunes or Stitcher and look for To the Best of Our Knowledge. And don't forget to leave a review. That helps other people find the show, and plus we always like knowing what you think. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson with help from Craig Ely, Raymond Tungekar, Charles Monroe Kane, and Doug Gordon. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen at Walk West Music. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.